And I'm going to read a few poems, and then I'm going to read a short story, and then finish off with another few poems. And I'm going to read from my first collection of poetry. It's called Red Riding Hood's Dilemma. And a number of my poems will be Africa-based, because I grew up there. There's only a few of them, so won't be too boring. I'll read the title poem first. It's very short. Red Riding Hood's Dilemma. Should I kill the wolf or invite him to tea? Sitting down with a napkin draped across upon his lap and feed him sponge fingers instead of meat. We lived in Australia for a while, and my father and I travelled back to Ireland via Russia. And I realised that can be a cautious or pretentious statement, but it's just true. And I was just beginning to love poetry, because where we lived in Africa, we had hardly any TV, so I read an awful lot of books. And then in Australia, I just got into poetry. And so we ended up in Moscow, and then later on in Leningrad. And so I wrote a poem a while ago about that time. This one is still called Leningrad, and it's now back to St. Petersburg. Later in Leningrad, there were no troikas that winter. The Neva flowed, and I had loved no poets yet. Instead, I admired the preserved face of Lenin, as we were supposed to. And there were scent basils, icons, gold and beauty. In a hairdresser's, we sipped coffee and bought rubles with US dollars. There was Olga, tall and in love with our Canadian friend. For two nights, she loved him, and I studied how she grasped him. In tea rooms by the Arbat, I was mistaken for an English girl by soldiers who sang opera and tried to make me smile. And later in Leningrad, I stood still. I stood still, and I remembered the first name. A while ago, I was in a photographic exhibition in Galway, one of those world photographic exhibitions, and I came across a photograph of a woman holding her brother's skull in her hand. And it stunned me. It was all she had of him after the wars in Bosnia and in the mid-90s, early to the 90s. So I wrote a poem about her because she stayed with me. They give you to me a numbered skull from a high shelf, and in my hand you are a strange brute thing, a thing I hardly see, my brother. The clean, smooth bone of you, the whole of you no longer with me. In this room of discovered skulls, I have lost my memories, and the photographer fixes your dead stare for his lens. In this room of skulls, your face is lost, my brother, and I grip hard to what is left. I have a thing about Russia and its history. I'm a great history buff. I love Russian literature and poets. I can't speak a word of Russian, so I have to depend on translations. But one of the poets that I fell in love with was Akhmatova, Anna Akhmatova. And she always struck me as a very, very great woman. I mean, she was one of the poets didn't desert Russia during Stalin, which was a very difficult thing to do. And she said that she was constantly bombarded by calls from friends in Paris to come over to get out of Russia, which she never did. And also her son Lev was in prison. And one day she sat down and she wrote a poem complimenting Stalin just to get Lev out of prison. And she succeeded for a little while, but then he was rearrested. So this is really a poem just to her. My words cannot delineate you, as Montigliani drew in the dark Paris mornings. And later, during the terror, you wandered mad at the edge, three lovers gone, a son imprisoned. Perhaps the death-choked eyes of Svetlana haunted you. Beloved exiles beckoned, but you turned your body tall and violet and breathed blood-fingered air. We lived in Malawi for a while, and my parents were teachers there. It was run by a dictator, and you had to be very careful. If you were black, you were, I mean, it's something against the government, so if you said anything, if you're, especially if you were Polish or if you were anyway sort of a dissident, you disappeared. We lived in a place called Lomba. We used to get into the car. We lived about 3 miles out into the bush, and we used to get into the car every morning. We were taken to school, our parents would take them to school, and on the left hand side on the way into Zomba, you could see the wire fence, and you knew very well there were people incarcerated in there. You never saw them, but you knew they were there. And our parents had warned us, you never say anything against the government, at all. So we learned to keep our mouths shut. After Sunday Mass in Malawi, we used to all congregate after Mass in Malawi, and everybody would catch up on the gossip. And because we were little, we'd run amongst all the adults and you'd hear things. After Sunday Mass in Malawi, they whispered, he was a poet perhaps, a dissident, yes. He ignored the spies in his classroom. Then someone else also remembered, of course, this is not our country. We are white, they see, and cannot disappear so easily. A while ago I went to Paris with my sisters, and I didn't enjoy myself. It was one of my sisters wasn't really particularly interested in the Louvre, and I think we actually did the Louvre in 30 minutes. Sorry. We wandered then up to Montmartre, and we turned them down, and I suddenly realised we're in the sixth district, and my sister had two young children with her, and so we had to frog march the two of them down towards the end of the street where the quick restaurant was, and so once we get there we're safe. So this is just kind of just like this. Lament of Paris. Toulouse is missing, and I can't stand Paris. The measly smiles from sex workers, nor the Eiffel Towers, bling bling. Hemingway has disappeared, and Josephine Baker isn't dancing anymore. And I'm too young to notice the urine streets and the resonant faces of the street kids on the boulevard to cliché, sidestepping metro events and finishing deals. Since Toulouse is always missing, and Montmartre is a back street, and the Moulin Rouge flounces its doors, I should be picking up stories from the stones. Instead, I buy a Nutella crepe that I had from the hands of a Congolese girl. And like Van Gogh, the night above dies bright into darkness, while bodies peel from mold and a boy touches me but I don't touch back. Instead, I eat my chocolate mess and so damn my frail romance of Paris. Which brings me to my story. There's a story that was published in the Horizon Review, and it's going to be my forthcoming short story collection. And it's called The Secret Life of Madame Defarge. And Dickens was always a hero of mine, and I love The Tale of Two Cities. And I always felt slightly sorry for Madame Defarge. I never really knew why, but I always did. And I think I began to see her as somebody with a story way beyond the story that you've read in the papers in the book. And so I sort of made up a story about her. And during the French Revolution, people still expected love to save them, or failing that, some brand of loyalty imprinted from friend to friend, servant to kind master, lover to lover, man to God. They expected love or loyalty at every last moment, at every last second, just before the guillotine's blade sliced its way to their necks. How many then called for God, or at least for someone to miraculously save them? A hand of God or an angel's wing. It was the fear that killed most of them before the blade did. That gut-sick fear of watching your own feet walk to your death. The buckles on your shoes that used to glint up, now shone up shit and blood and the stink from your own person, and the green spit smeared on the mob's faces. If you were to ask anyone of those that faced their death that way, they would say something similar, how the faces of the crowd crept into each other's, The laughter and the seething hunger of the blood and the sound of neck bones snapping was echoed in the chittering of the mob's teeth, as if small carnivorous insects crawled from separate tongues and set up an orchestra of death and heat. Madame Defarge seemed no different, and although she did not exist in anything other than an ancient novel, she existed well enough in the sidelines of the guillotine, as she knitted away the lives of the filthy aristocracy. Her breath puffed over the frilled neckline of her new dress, which she had been so careful to raise above the blood and the crab's spit and urine. Her friend Rosa sat next to her underneath the guillotine. Rosa was easily bored and was tired of waiting. She had a lover, she said, big, with muscled arms, that her arms could not get around. She tapped her foot, looked this way and that, and went at Madame Defarge. Aethereth, do you want to know his name? Madame Defarge ignored her. She was also bored, but hid it under her smile. Rosa said nothing else, but her eyes stayed too long on Madame Defarge's face. He's a good lover, Therese, she said, eventually. Madame Defarge shrugged. She decided to say nothing. But he says things in his dreams, Rosa added. Madame Defarge leaned forward and gazed at the far edge of the crowd. There were dark birds in the sky waiting for blood and meat. Madame Defarge grunted a little. She had loved the guillotine for months, but death was rampant now. Aristocracy had to be erased, priests and nuns also, and those who had insisted that all of this was against God's order must be put to death in the same way. They were killing others too. People who asked questions, people who read the books priests had read, people who wondered why the leaders of the revolution still looked richer than others, people who said maybe Robespierre was getting a little bit too big for his boots. Even Madame Defarge, with her new petticoats and her fancy walk. Well, no wonder people sometimes look at you, Rosa had mentioned once. Madame Defarge focused on her knitting. She had lost count of all of the names, and now she just used colours, red, white, green, and the colours of the rich magenta, aubergines, crimson, burnt sienna like mustard on her Risto's dinner plate, and blue like the hottest sky, the sort of blue that seemed to reach inside your lungs and make breathing a hard pleasure. These were the things that made Madame Defarge uneasy these days. Death could not satisfy her. It stank, it dirtied her new clothes. Clothes that she tried to hide in the beginning, but Rosa had noticed. Rosa with her quick insect eyes and plucking fingers. Rosa had jumped. Therese Defarge had a wrist of bones hidden beneath her skin. Rosa, whose nails smelt of ingrained shit from wiping all her arms with her fingers. Rosa, who had not changed. Rosa, who had not kept up with her best friend, but Rosa had not needed to. His name was Ernst, like her husband, Rosa had whispered. Madame Defarge felt a terrible fear being at the edges of her heart. Something she suspected he had never dared take as the truth. Her husband inside Rosa's thighs. She smiled and said nothing. She wound some wool around her finger and readied it for the needle. She glanced up at the congregating birds that fluffed out their wings, picked fleas with their beaks, and looked back at her with dead black eyes. Madame Defarge plucked at the neckline of her dress to cover her breast from the sudden chill. The man in the crowd caught her eyes and licked his lips. Here they come, Rosa sang. In the beginning, Madame Defarge had relished the guillotine. It suited her grief to have a bloodlust underlying her sorrow. It made her get up in the mornings. It made her sell wine and march each day to the Place de la Révolution to cheer on the executions. It made the memory of her son settle in her heart, his soft black hair and his green eyes, his mouth in her breast when he was a baby, and his thin narrow chest against her stomach when he was older and still not man enough to ignore her. Oh, Madame Defarge knew love. She knew how it burned in her grief and had turned it into a hot hate, and at night in her husband's arms she pleaded with him to fuck her so that a new child would grow. She even prayed to God to make her husband someone who could save her in this way. She had watched Ernst's teeth tear meat from chicken bones and watched his tongue fight its way through gristle and fat, and she had longed for his teeth and tongue. He did not kiss her anymore. After their son's death, Ernst Defarge remained quiet. His eyes said nothing, as if they had turned dark, but they really. And I found a forest thought of the sun, soft and warm against her, and his breath bubbling at her breast. She thought of her husband covering herself up. She thought of Rosa opening her legs. Rosa, whose belly had never grown full, no matter how many men got inside her. Madame Farge pressed her fist into her stomach. She closed her eyes and imagined that she was a different woman, someone Ernst would love, someone he would never expect to discover in his old wife's kitchen or in her bedroom in the dead secret night when she whispered her craving to him. She had tried to be any kind of woman to him. He liked them gentle, she knew, soft and sweet, like birds with velvet breasts. Rosa was smaller. Rosa had fairer skin and thin wrists and a body that looked too much like a child. She leaned forward like a child to watch the tumbler as it made its way to the guillotine steps. Madame Defarge shifted within her own large hips and noticed how her new dress stretched tight across her knees. It smelled of roses and lavender. The woman who had worn it before her had been smaller. Delicate arms and breasts with thin collarbones on a white skin. Perhaps she'd listened to poetry under a lamplight with the sour smell of wine in a glass outside her fingers, pretty fingers, small like those of a porcelain doll. Or perhaps she looked like the young girl who had now stepped from the tumbler. Madame Defarge stopped knitting. She stared as the girl was put forward in the queue. She waited as the girl grew level, and then Madame Defarge reached out with one knitting needle and tapped the girl's forearm. The girl turned like a broken doll turns on its final hinge, and she smiled at Madame Defarge and smiled back. The girl's face was swollen. Her teeth were crushed and her bottom lip had been torn out. Madame Defarge murmured at the girl as he would at a frightened kitten. For all those seconds that she stared and smiled at the girl, Madame Defarge wanted many things. She wanted this girl's once lovely face and body. She wanted the sound the air would have made this girl would have danced through it all those times before. Madame Defarge longed for the smell of perfumed candles and goose heart and jelly. She longed for a gilt bed and bread as white as clouds. Yet at the edge of her longing, there was a sound that Madame Defarge recognized. It was a crowd silence. It breathed in against her. "Kill the bitch," Madame Defarge screamed. She jabbed her needles into the girl's arm and thrust her face close to the girl's destroyed mouth. Then she spat hard. "Kill the bitch," she screamed again. Her knitting group took up the chant. The needles clapped in time. "Kill the bitch. Kill the bitch, kill the bitch." The girl was lifted by her elbows and Madame Defarge pulled with joy. Her bloodlust blackened the inside of her mind so that she thought and smelled nothing else but the hot iron odor of blood. The mob joined in Madame's scream for death. Their eyes swiveled from watching the girl being positioned at the edge of the guillotine to the woman roaring into the air and stabbing her knees into the sun. "Kill the bitch, kill the little whore," Madame Defarge screamed. "Kill the bitch, kill the whore," the mob ranted. The stench and sticky thrill of blood made snobs. The mob sniffed death like a lover. The girl's beauty was exaggerated against the executioner's bulk, and the sun caught the line of her limbs to her shift. Madame Defarge glanced over the crowd. She could not see her husband, but she knew his face had the same look that was on every other man's face. The girl was laid on the board and then slid forward so that her head and neck hung over the waiting basket. The mob silenced. The girl's lips were moving. Out of nowhere, Madame Defarge cried out, "What's your name? What's your name?" "Who cares?" said Rosa and elbowed Madame Defarge into silence before smiling up at the girl. "Bye-bye, pretty," Rosa called up to the girl. "Don't forget your prayers, little bird. Don't forget to fly away when your head is gone." The girl stared down at Madame Defarge and held up her hands as if to pluck the girl from her death. The girl was praying so hard now that her vision had melted the crowd into a dark sea that murmured like a lullaby. Madame Defarge saw the blade and stuck out her fingers to stop it. She wanted a name. She thought a new name to raise, a new dress and a new perfume, a new woman for Ernst, a new child. "Tell me your name," she screamed right into the heart of the mob's silence, and the girl's head dropped into the basket. The mob cheered. The girl's head was lifted. It looked too small to be real. Madame Defarge gazed at it. "No name," she realized. "No name." "Like a pretty plum," Rosa laughed. "Entrez. Plucked like a pretty plum." She pulled Trinity needles into Madame Defarge's new dress, paused, then stepped closer to Madame Defarge's ear and whispered, "You are in the way, Therese." Madame Defarge stepped back, her knitting had fallen into the slime underfoot. The birds had settled down to eating. The sky was still blue and hard. Ernst was either in the tavern or waiting for Rosa. Madame Defarge sat down on her bench. She was tired. The guillotine pointed down on the necks of the remaining prisoners, and Madame Defarge stopped counting after a while. Just a couple more poems and then I'll finish. I grew up, my grandparents and my grandmother had a sweet shop, and we used to help run it, of course, and some days we'd get old men come in from it, and one in particular was from it. He had fought, he'd flown Spitfires in the Second World War. He developed a nervous shape to his head, and he always come in and sweet Aston. He was a very nice old man, but he never would talk about the war. The man from the Second World War came into our sweet shop today. He stood by the fried chocolate glass mirror and smoked all his cares away. He had old man's hands and old man's eyes, and his clothes smelled of sweat and piss. He was too old, too friendly to, and too dried up to kiss. As we sometimes did for old people who asked to kiss for those whom my grandmother said were sometimes better off dead. She was used to kind men who screamed like children in size, and the man from the Second World War had something to hide. He once flew Spitfires straight into German skies, and we buoyed up with cartoon and childish thrills and asked him, "What's it like to really kill?" I really love one now, actually. It's called and it doesn't have any explanation. Down then, down the purest and the love of brightness, the pure fear of love, give me life, give me God, give me flesh. Down pristine eliteness of manner, cool, well-toned voices, cautious and serene. Down manufactured spirits of beauty, careful love, controlled lives. Give me wide, wild spirits. Give me terrible, tumbling passion. Give me love that rips my soul open to you. And give me the lust of your eyes that slams against my body. Give me your wetness, their skin. I damn their hateful saintliness, their rules of normality. They watch us with snake-like caution. We love you and I, and damn them. We were living in Kenya. We lived in a place called Gandu, and it was run by Italian nuns who were lovely, absolutely lovely, and they loved us. We used to run up to them just to see them. It was a big pain to walk and see the chickens and see the nuns, because we used to grab us by our cheeks, you know, especially the cooks used to grab us like that all the time by our cheeks. And one day anyway, my brother came down from the nuns, and he was traumatized. And we thought, oh my God, we didn't know what had happened. My mother did not know. And she finally got it out of him that he had seen a nun grab a chicken, slam it down into some wood and chop its head off. And then the chicken, of course, got up and flapped around for a while. Mm-hmm. So, in Kenya, we knew Italian nuns who snatched chicken necks and swung pig sausage from kitchen rafters. Mm-hmm. They smelled of soup and incense and dug their fingers into our cheeks. Sign of endearment. Dangerous women we decided and loved them back. We dragged dead pigeons to their door and walked barefoot in their rooms. Sometimes they seemed to pray, but when they caught the chickens, my sister, brother and I sat, watched and waited. We were quite bloodthirsty. This next poem is called I Saw Beckett the Other Day, and it's one of those kind of poems that come out of nowhere. Because of course I never met Becca, so it's completely new. But I've always liked his writing, even though I haven't always understood it, and I don't mind admitting that. And sometimes his writing is quite frightening because it is quite bleak, so you have to even look beyond that for something else. I saw Beckett the other day in the doorway of that cafe where you took his photographs, you know the one, when he looked up at the lens and realised how he could haunt us all. "Hey Beckett," I said, rejoicing in my discovery of him, his hand on the door, his eyes skimming over the interior image of cigarette smoke and coffee. I stood beside him. He rubbed his face so he might recognise me. I smiled and said even I didn't know what was happening these days. Even I could not stop the end. He nodded, coughed and looked sly. His teeth were yellow over the pink rims of his lips. He mentioned the photograph. He said his face had collected worms under the skin as if ready for death, and he smiled to show them dance spasmodic with age spots and veins. Someone entered the cafe, someone left. Beckett touched the hair above my ear. I stood on tiptoe so he could whisper down. He said nothing. It was just a kiss and the cold wind at our feet and the smoke and egg-friendly air released in drafts between the opening and closing of the cafe door. Which he stepped through to find his table and enter some other world under greasy lights, coupled with table shine and coffee cups. And thoughts of death, where she stood, groomed for an entrance, were held back by the odd moments of life that still strung the useful breath Beckett used to blow his coffee cool. I'm going to read my last poem now, and it's a poem that I wrote for my sisters and my brother when we came back from our travels, when we finally settled in Ireland. And even in between, we were always asked about our accent, we were asked about where we had been, and we tell them, and then the next question was always, and where else have you been? So this is to my sisters and my brother. Sometimes we were mistaken for Canadians, and because we replied Australian, we seemed to make sense. School friends demanded why we weren't black since it came from Africa too. And where else? Well, we climbed the anthills on the way to Mombasa, spoke Swahili but lived in Kikuyu land. We avoided the secret police in Malawi, grew used to the prison fence that hid the disappeared. And in Australia we learned the Irish are preferred to English. Greeks and Italians are nicknamed the Wogs, and Aboriginals must look good for the tourists. And where else? There's Russia and Lenin's court, Israel, bombs in the marketplace, and Turkish delight under our pillows. And where else? And it was easy to explain away. Well, you see, we'd say, our parents are Irish, but we really were from somewhere else. So thank you very much.